The new book of photography by Omar Rodriguez Lopez, chronicling a period from about 2001 to 2005. The last track we heard, This Apparatus Must Be Unearthed, comes from the Mars Volta's 2003 record, so towards the end of the period documented in this book. The drums at the beginning that sound a little washed out, or maybe like they were recorded in a bathroom, well, there is a picture in this book of drummer John Theodore smashing some drums in what appears to be like a locker room shower. It's all tile. Anyway, so there's all sorts of cool stuff like that, along with, as I mentioned, a lot of candids of Cedric and Omar and other band members and friends, family, beautiful pictures of clouds from airplane windows, all sorts of stuff. So please check it out if you're interested. You can find it at Akashic Books. That's www.akashicbooks.com. That's A-K-A-S-H-I-C. Books.com, akashicbooks.com, Akashic Books. Check it out. I highly recommend it. And thanks to them for sending me a copy to look at. Okay, we're going to hear from one of those 59 releases. We're going back, solo releases, excuse me. We're going back to the beginning of, no, sorry, the, well, oh my gosh. Okay, near the beginning of Omar Rodriguez's solo releases his fourth solo release is called Se Dice Bisonte No Bufalo, and that translates to it's called A Bison, Not a Buffalo, which you should know if it's in North America, it's a bison. Buffalo are in Africa and Asia. Anyway, this album comes from a little later than the period, well, it was released in 2007, so after the period chronicled in this book, but, you know, it takes a long time to work on stuff, so I would not be surprised to hear that a lot of what is on this album was being worked on during the period documented in Hunters in High Heels. I'm going to play you this one, which in long-standing Omar Rodriguez Lopez tradition, not quite started at this record, all the way back to the first record, it's like this, but some pretty crazy titles. This one is called Boiling Death Request, A Body to Rest Its Head On, by Omar Rodriguez Lopez, from his album Se Dice Bisonte No Bufalo, as I give a glowing, strong review and endorsement of his book of photography, Hunters in High Heels.
My name's Eric Swanson, and I'm a dad of two young girls. It was a game changer when we learned that $10 a day childcare was being offered to both our kids. And we want all BC families to have this option. To get there, BC has to do three key things. Pay fair and consistent wages for all childcare educators. Transition all existing programs to $10 a day. And plan childcare expansion more like we do schools and hospitals. BC's on the right track, but we need to go faster. Go to 10aday.ca to learn more.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nazarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. A group of researchers at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, BC, are using archaeology as a means of Indigenous reconciliation and heritage protection. The Hoyatai Laskiti Archaeology Project, also known as XLAP, is working towards advancing reconciliation among the Indigenous and settler populations of Laskiti Island, which is a remote island located off the east coast of Vancouver Island in the Strait of Georgia. Starting in 2021, XLAP is continuously being worked on by a community of volunteers and researchers from both Indigenous and settler communities, as well as Indigenous knowledge holders from Comox Nation, Tohaamen Nation, Wiwakum Nation, Kualakum Nation, and Halalt Nation. Recently, a talk on XLAP was hosted by Dana Lepofsky, a professor of archaeology at SFU, leader of the XLAP project, and a resident of Laskiti, as well as project leader and professor of resource and environmental management, Sean Markey. CJSF attended the event and spoke with Lepofsky and Markey about the ways in which they believe this project has been able to honor, respect, and protect Indigenous heritage in Laskiti. One of the main ways that they've been able to achieve this has been through public outreach and education. Until recently, it was widely believed by the residents of Laskiti that there was no Indigenous heritage or presence on the island. According to Lepofsky and Markey, this research project has undoubtedly dispelled this myth.
And I should say that I'm a resident here. I was a part-time resident for many decades and now a full-time resident. So I have been kind of slowly working away at talking to people about Indigenous history and to break down that myth of First Nations were never here permanently. Okay, they came here to collect resources, but they certainly didn't live here full time. There weren't very big numbers. You know, there was a lot of that same kind of truce going around, but slowly, surely over the decades of working with community members and going to fall fairs and to the market and giving talks, many people started to realize that, oh yeah, really, this doesn't make sense. And we're so happy to embrace it. But even with that, it was just kind of slow baby steps forward. And I was surprised that when we launched our project we got the funding, well, you know, in the same month that everything shut down around COVID, I was surprised that even given me doing this for decades and living here and being known to people and having pretty widespread group of friends, that people still didn't know. So it took this kind of massive amount of effort on the project team's part to actually, now no one can say they haven't heard it. Some people still don't believe it, but everybody has heard it and most people embrace it.
Afterwards, Sean Markey expanded on the planning and policy aspect of the research project.
You know, this is where the planning and the policy piece comes in, is that those two systems have also done nothing really to educate people, to make information available to people. There's nothing, for example, you know, there should be, and there's sort of, as I articulated in the talk, there is good policy in place about, you know, what it's illegal to disrupt Indigenous heritage and those types of things. But in terms of its presence and ready access to information about where sites are, incorporating knowledge about sites and what it means to have a site on property within the real estate process, for example, is all pretty much completely absent and very much, again, just simply reflective of those colonial myths and colonial systems that are in place to really not value it. And as I mentioned in the talk, it has really sort of more seen Indigenous heritage as a barrier to facilitating the development and something of value in its own right.
Later on in the discussion, Lepofsky emphasized the importance of indigenous communities and knowledge holders playing a leading role in archaeological research such as this.
And it shouldn't happen. This is the thing, is that archaeology is this extraordinarily privileged position, as is planners who get to make or enact different policies around indigenous heritage. We're the outsiders. It's not our heritage. So it's kind of a funny position in a way. So it's a privilege to be able to talk about planning and archaeology of someone else's heritage. And so it can't happen. It shouldn't happen. It would be silly for it to happen without, a partnered endeavor.
Since this research project focuses primarily on Luskidi or Huayatai, we decided to ask Dana Lepofsky if she could explain how similar research could be utilized to advance Indigenous reconciliation in somewhere such as Burnaby.
I believe really strongly in the power of archaeology, and it's been an archaeological part of the archaeological culture with some good reasons to actually keep where archaeological sites are private, because a couple bad actors will always come in and do some damage and trespass and dig up things. And so it's meant that the public doesn't really know or see archaeology. But I think they want to. So over all the years, every time I've done an excavation, one of the criteria that I have when I'm working with community members is we can go anywhere in your territory you want, but I also want to do something that's very public, that's very accessible. And I sometimes even design my excavation units so that, I've done this quite a few times, so that people can gather around them. So it's safe, easy access and easy viewing, because I believe in the power of archaeology to change. And it's not just for settlers, it's for Indigenous youth as well. When you see this colonial landscape with manicured lawns and gardens and stuff, it's hard to know unless someone helps you see that right below their feet is thousands of years of their own history. So I talk about kind of teaching people to have archaeology eyes. So in Burnaby, easy. We could pick a place. And every time we've done this, I always say to my husband, oh, no one's going to come, no press are going to come. But anyway, after all these years, I think I'd know, but so wrong. People come in droves. They want to know. People love archaeology. They're drawn to it, even if they don't necessarily yet jive with the truth around Indigenous history. They still love the archaeology. There's a cool factor. Actually, we have a student who's doing interviews about that. What is it about that that we're drawn to around the material objects and the like? So I would say what we're doing here has parallels in so many places, and many places are doing this. It helps here because it's an island, so it's easy, it's contained. We know our audience, but in the Fraser Valley where I've worked and other places, it's the same story. People will come. You just need to make it open and available and inviting, and you need to keep at it, and you need to make sure that to really make systemic change, you need to work with the policy folks. You need to, in Burnaby, you need to work with the municipality in Burnaby, do the exact same thing, have public archaeology, have people come, have people participate, work with the teachers. It's all the same playbook, really.
Lastly, Sean Markey expanded on this sentiment and explained how local governments could be doing more to collaborate with local Indigenous communities.
I would add, I mentioned the talk just as a planner. Somewhat familiar with what archaeology is, but I had no real true appreciation for how powerful it can be to mediate conversations in the present. In addition to that engaged archaeological approach that Dana was just talking about, I witnessed, really powerfully firsthand within the XLAP project, the power of building relationships, of just gathering together with settlers, with nations. Some of the fear drops away, right? The fear of doing the wrong thing, for example, which I know can inhibit a lot of local governments from just simply reaching out. They're worried about offending or doing the wrong thing, or they don't know how. A common response that I hear from nations is, well, you could phone and ask, right? So, I think, creating pathways where settlers can interact with nations and learn about their history is incredibly powerful.
Once again, you were listening to Dana Lepofsky and Sean Markey, two leading researchers, a part of the Huayatai Lascidi archaeology project that is working towards using their archaeological findings to educate the island's residents on its indigenous history, as well as foster and advance indigenous reconciliation on Lascidi. Once again, this has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This segment would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
This is Bird Note. Perched atop a cactus in the American Southwest, a strikingly patterned brown bird sings a gravelly refrain. Its harsh, foreboding quality seems to capture the mood of the arid, thorn-studded landscape. Our singer is the size of a red-winged blackbird, but it's a wren, a very large one, called the cactus wren. Most wrens in North America are small, furtive birds that stay deep in the vegetation. The bold, brassy cactus wren is the northernmost species of a group of tropical wrens, all big wrens with complex social behavior. You might see a whole family group of cactus wrens foraging together in search of large insects and cactus fruits. These wrens are well adapted to the desert and can get all the moisture they need from their food. Cactus wrens are a regular sight in their range of dry habitats from West Texas to California. The nest looks like a football made of twigs stuck horizontally in a thorny tree or choya cactus. The nest is easily seen, but well guarded by the spiky vegetation. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Welcome back to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. I'm Jesse. You have heard a whole bunch of stuff this show, including Danny's interview there about the Lascidi Archaeology Project and the role of archaeology where it comes to reconciliation, a topic that is, I suppose, close to my heart as a, an archaeology degree holder and a person who believes strongly in the need for reconciliation. So, cool piece there. You can find that and other news pieces produced by participants in the Local Journalism Initiative at frequencynews.ca, which there's lots of cool stuff on there. And, you know, there's lots of cool stuff going on in, well, lots of interesting and cool, not always cool, but usually interesting stuff going on in communities all across the country that local journalists are reporting on thanks to this initiative. So, support local journalism and go read / listen to a bunch more of it. And stay tuned here to hear a little bit of that every morning on Speak Up. The other thing you hear on this show when I'm hosting is a lot of local music. Sunset Rubdown are not really local, but kind of local, sometimes haunting Vancouver Island, sometimes various places across the country as they disperse. They have reconvened for a new record called Always Happy to Explode, which came out last year, but just got added to the CJSF playlist. I'm a huge fan of this band and all Spencer Krug related projects, like Omar Rodriguez Lopez, very prolific and a very distinct voice. Let's listen to this track, which just I love. It really got me when I heard it the first time, by Sunset Rubdown from their record Always Happy to Explode. This is Reappearing Rat. We'll be right back. Reappearing Rat by Sunset Rubdown from Always Happy to Explode here on Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. I just want to remind you that Hunters in High Heels, the photography book collecting the works of Omar Rodriguez Lopez, is out now on Akashic Books. You can check it out on their website and order it there. I highly recommend it. And to close us out, we're going to play a cover, a local artist, Finn, covering Toxicity by System of a Down. I saw Omar Rodriguez Lopez's band, the Mars Volta, perform open for System of a Down at the Pacific Coliseum back in, probably 2006, 2005, 6, 7, somewhere in there. And it was one of the worst. System of a Down's performance was one of the worst I'd ever seen. They just stood around. It was not great. Kind of killed that band for me. But I was a huge fan before that. And I'm sad that I stopped listening at that point. Anyway, here's a local cover of one of their biggest songs. This one is called Toxicity. And then Democracy Now! Will be up right after. Thanks for listening. Speak Up will be back on Thursday. Intravenous is up at this time tomorrow, Wednesday. Check that out. See you next time.
Conversion software version 7.0. Looking at life through the eyes of a tire hope. Eating seeds as a pastime activity. The toxicity of our city, our city. Disorder, disorder.
that shone life into the man's heart. When I became the sun, I shone life into the man's heart. When I became the sun, I shone life into the man's heart.
I'm Kaylin.
And I'm Rebecca.
We're the hosts of Sociologic, broadcasting live at CJSF 90.1 FM,